The show originally aired on January 26th, 2025. This is Radio Catskill.
Welcome. You're tuned to WJFF, serving Northeast Pennsylvania and New York's Catskills. I'm Angela Page, and this show is Folk Plus. I've been covering the folk field since the mid-70s, including writing for musical publications, running a folk club in Greenwich Village, and being on the air since the 90s. Thanks so much for tuning in to Folk Plus. Stay tuned for today's theme. Today on Folk Plus, you will hear an interview I did this week with Terry Thall. She's written a book called My Greenwich Village, Dave, Bob, and Me. Dave stands for Dave Van Ronk, her first husband. Bob Dylan, and me, 21-year-old who came to New York in the 60s to Greenwich Village. I'm reading from the Barnes & Noble's page about her book. Mark Elliott's review, who was the best-selling author of Phil Oakes' Death of a Rebel. Here's what Mark says. Terry's memoirs told from the privileged position of not only having been there for the crowning, but as a woman on the cultural front lines. Her detailed recall brings a fresh perspective on the Greenwich Village folk scene of the 60s. Terry was certainly embedded in the folk music scene, but she came to it from her work in social justice, which she still continues. If you're a listener to Folk Plus, you know I play quite a lot of music during the hour. Well, this show is mostly an interview. There will just be little bits of music to accentuate some of the points being made in the dialogue. Reading from her press release, she was 21-year-old and Bob Dylan's first manager prior to his contract with Albert Grossman and Columbia. She also managed Dave Van Ronk, who later became her husband.
When that moon begins to glow, all the lights turn down low, when it's time to go to sleep.
The Roach Sisters. Paul Jeremiah. And the Holy Modal Rounders, among others. She's going to be speaking in the Village February 7th and in Ossining, New York, in a bookstore there in March. But here she is, talking to us, the audience for Folk Plus. She begins by giving the vibe economically of artists trying to make it in the village. Here's Terry Thall.
In the late 1950s and early 60s, before anybody could earn a living doing folk music in New York, and in the late 50s, you couldn't. Before 1960, 61, there was no place to work. Everybody was singing the same stuff. Everybody. Except a couple of collectors was singing the stuff that they learned on the Harry Smith records.
What Terry is referring to here is the Anthology of American Folk Music, issued in 52. It was gospel, blues, Cajun, fiddle music, all recorded in the late 20s and in the 30s. Dave Van Ronk was quoted as saying, "It was the Bible for hundreds of us."
And a few people like Dave were augmenting it. I mean, Dave augmented it with stuff that he learned from jazz. But they were all singing 30 songs.
Yeah.
Really and truly. Every
Valid. Yeah.
girl singer, every girl singer in New York sang a cuckoo. Every one of them. Every guy singer sang John Henry. That's, you know.
Well, would you say 57 was sort of the magic year when it began to kind of all come together? Was it later than
It was
57?
later than 57. It was like David and I started to live together in 59.
Okay.
And I crashed in a high school teaching license because he could not make a living. There was literally, quite literally, no place for him to work. None. Not one place to get on stage. We had started a thing called the Folk Singers Guild, which was, you know, a group of young folk singers who put on occasional concerts so they could get on stage and make $2, $15, until John Mitchell opened the Gaslight, which was the first, and it was a basket house. There literally was nothing, quite literally nothing.
And tiny, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not, weren't even small places. There were zilch places. They didn't exist. Older people like Cynthia Gooding and Pete Seeger, you know, and the Weavers, I mean, and whether or not they were in the Communist Party, had an occasional stage. You know, you read about somebody produced concerts at PS 41 in the Village. A concert, somebody or other produced a concert of Gene Ritchie and Oscar Brand. Theo Bucal sang occasionally, and Cynthia K sang occasionally, but they mostly sang in theaters, small theaters, after a play ended on a weekend night, like the Theatre d'Elysée, where Three Penny Opera opened and played. Before that, there had been some folk music at Café Society, which was the first interracial nightclub in New York, and it was in the Village. It was a once in a while thing for older, to us they were older people.
Well, then when did the
60, 61,
61? And then,
66, maybe 60.
and what would be the clubs then?
The Gaslight,
Right?
which was a basket house, and that opened as a place for poets.
Right.
John booked in poets, and I wrote about that, and I know you know that. You know, he hired, quote, beat poets.
Yeah, I'd like to get to several things today, if we can. Your book, where you talk about the whole scene that you knew. I'd like to talk about your political world, because sometimes the women in these stories kind of get lost.
Yeah.
And Llewellyn Davis, 10 years ago, I wrote you a note, and we were going to do an interview about Llewellyn Davis, since you were such a knowledgeable source from the time, and especially from Dave. And then, of course, The Complete
You
Unknown.
see, did you ever see the review I wrote in the Village Voice?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Her article is still up on the web, December 13th, 2013, in the Village Voice. She talks about how in the movie, no one was nice. In reality, she says, quote, musicians supported each other. David and I had hordes of people in the apartment several times a week. Folk singers, uninvited drop-ins who always were welcome. I cooked. We talked politics. Musicians played. They introduced new songs and jammed. We all had fun. But you wouldn't know that from inside Llewellyn Davis. She talks more about the movie in a minute. But right now, we focus on the Dylan movie that perhaps some of you have seen recently, Complete Unknown. Well, let's focus on the Dylan movie first, The Complete Unknown. I'll read what Mitch Greenhill, I came across Mitch Greenhill, whose dad founded the Folklore Productions. He said when he saw the Dylan movie that's out, "I think I might have enjoyed it more if I hadn't known so many of the characters." And
Yeah.
I feel like that could be your story, and I'd love for you to elaborate.
I mean, it's like if I didn't know those people, I guess it wouldn't bother me.
Well, that's why I'd like you to fill in some of the nooks and crannies. You were there at the time. You knew these characters. His girlfriend was not the quiet, waiting for him to give her attention person.
Wimpy,
that, yeah.
wimpy, crybaby.
And Joan wasn't in the picture till she was not in the picture. Do you want to talk about that, the way they played up a love triangle that what didn't really exist?
Well, basically, I thought the movie was pretty well done. I mean, they had to create an arc. I mean, I tend to be very literal. I go to the movies and I want to see an honest, clear, accurate portrayal of somebody. That's me. So that I tend not to like this kind of thing. That being said, I thought it was pretty well done. You know, I know that they have to create a starting point and where it's going to. So there is this arc that starts here and it's going to wind up here. And it's got to make a certain kind of motion that gets you there. So there has to be character and energy and all that stuff in there. I got that. And I think they did it fairly well. I think the acting is excellent.
Yes.
I hear, you know, I've heard criticisms of it, but I mean, nobody is who they're playing. So granted that, I think the acting is very good. I think the music is very good. I think they did a wonderful job on that. I think they set up fairly well Bob's move from coming to New York, wanting to meet Woody Guthrie and be part of the New York folk music scene, to feeling that that scene was a little too restrictive for him, that he wanted to eventually, he wanted to move back into the rock world. And because Bob came out of the rock world, when Bob came to New York, it really wasn't very long before some of us, those of us who were his good friends, certainly knew that he was a Little Richard fan. And I thought he showed very good taste admiring Little Richard. I admired Little Richard. I thought Little Richard was great. Be that as it may, I didn't realize that he wanted to become Little Richard. I thought he wanted to become Woody Guthrie for a while. That's what he led us all to believe. And for a while, I think that's what he wanted. I think the movie set that whole thing in motion up pretty well. And I think there were limitations to how well it showed his thought process in figuring out where he wanted to go. And how he wanted to go there, how he wanted to get there. But that, you know, I come to a place, I want to be there, I get there, I'm successful in it. And then I say, gee, this isn't really what I want within this place. And this, incidentally, and this will take me into my politics, is a Marxist axiom that within something is the seed of change. I'm not going to say destruction, but change. Here I am, I get here, and within it, I find elements that'll take me somewhere better, that I want to go. I think the movie did a good job of that.
He almost created his own mystique. Like he wasn't showing people slowly who he was. He was kind of developing who he was as he went and decided, oh, I'm going to be like this, so I'm not going to answer that. He's just mysterious still. Still, yeah. Mysterious because it works for him. Why not?
Yes, you're right. And it took a while. It took a while to realize that.
But he definitely was very influenced and hung out with not only Phil Oakes, but you and Dave. And that was missing in the movie. And I know they can't cover everybody, but to me, it seemed like a big hole. Did that bother you?
A little. That's ego. You know, I mean, it's partly ego. It's partly accuracy. But, you know, if you look at it, I think David was gypped. And I will talk about that because I think David was treated very badly by that movie, not just because he didn't play a much bigger role, but I think David was eliminated. I think David was erased in that movie in a very negative, very bad way. not one person who isn't well known was shown in that movie. Not one. They used Pete as a major influence on him. And yes, Pete had an influence on him, but he and Pete did not have the kind of personal relationship that was shown in that movie. It was
Right.
not that personal. It wasn't that strong. It wasn't that big. Pete didn't take him places and introduce him to places and, and show him off that
I
way and
think
pat him on the head that way.
it's good to say this because people who are going for the first time trying to get a sense of the 60s and the village, they don't know. And
Yeah,
it's
I
great
mean,
to say, Van Rock would have done that for him. He took him under his wing. He had him on your, he was on your couch sleeping. He showed him, and Susie showing him different authors.
and other people did that too. He slept on the couch of the Mackenzies. He stayed Camilla Adams, who nobody knows.
I was going to say, I don't know Camilla
Yeah,
Adams.
right. Was treated him very well. He spent a lot of time at her place. There were a bunch of other people who put him up and who fed him. And I'm talking about non-folk singers. It's kind of interesting because David mentored him a bit, but Dave wasn't the only one. When Bob first hit New York, Bob was the most photographed young folk singer in Greenwich Village history. When I went online, Dave and I were not very well photographed. Dave wasn't that well photographed. I was barely photographed at all. I started looking for pictures for my book because I didn't have a lot of pictures to use. And I went online and I found thousands of pictures of Bob. I found pictures of Bob 2 days after he hit New York in the alley at Cafe Wa, in people's kitchens and people's bedrooms and people's sofas, smoking, smoking in the streets, walking everywhere. It was amazing that that didn't come only from the photographers. That came because of the support he got from folk singers. He was mentored, he was helped. I mean, it was a supportive community. I talk about that constantly, but I've never seen anyone get that kind of support.
Yeah, it took a village to create Bob Dylan.
Something like that.
Tell us the title of your book.
Well, my book is called My Greenwich Village, Dave, Bob, and
You're
Me.
on the cover there, walking with Dave and with Bob down the street.
Jim Marshall, who became a very, very famous rock photographer, that was one of his early musical assignments. Jim was assigned to take photographs of Bob. Bob and Susie and Dave and me went out to breakfast fairly often. And we went out to breakfast that day, and Jim was there and he was doing this photo shoot. And we walked down 7th Avenue South to Sheridan Square, and we walked in between, and Jim was shooting the whole time.
So your
And
book, what year does your book start?
the book starts with my childhood. I talk about growing up in Brooklyn. I talk about growing up in Bed-Stuy, which at the time was not a sexy neighborhood. It wasn't an expensive neighborhood. It was a neighborhood of immigrants, Irish immigrants, Jewish immigrants, which is where we fell into it. Both of my parents were from Eastern Europe,
Were they political? Because you slid
my
into.
parents were not political. They were not. I had one uncle who was a socialist. I didn't even know he was a socialist. We left Bed-Stuy for Flatbush when I was 11, and I spent my junior high school and high school years in Flatbush in Brooklyn. When I was in high school, it was the 1950s, which was a very quiet period in America. It was a period of McCarthyism when there were House Un-American Activity Committee hearings, and people were being summoned to Washington and being asked, "Are you now or were you ever a member of the Communist Party?" And I
Scary.
had no use for the Communist Party, but I did believe that every man, woman, and child should have adequate housing and food and water and education, and later I realized health care. And when I got to college, and I went to Brooklyn College, which at the time was free, but there was no tuition at Brooklyn College. It was a great school. The city colleges were fabulous. I went looking for organizations of people who believed where I could work as a volunteer and help foster a world that believed that. And that's how I got into folk music.
Yeah, so the social justice came first, and
Yeah.
then you
Yeah.
were drawn to other people. I guess, did you meet Dave in a social justice meeting, or how did you
I
meet?
met that. Well, what happened was I was sort of recruited by a socialist organization, and all the socialist organizations had headquarters in the village, which was, had a radius of what, a mile and a half. The world was very small then. There were maybe 200 people in the world. Some of them were socialists, and some of them were communists, and some of them were folk singers, and some of them were science fiction fans, and some of them were visual artists, and then some of them were jazz musicians. Maybe there were 500 people, but it was a little world, and people knew one another. They may not have interacted an awful lot, but they knew one another. And I met Dave at a meeting of science fiction fans.
He certainly was well read. He just knew.
He was incredible. And we spent an evening talking, and I didn't see him again for several months. And then I ran into him at the Figaro, which was a coffee house in the village where everybody hung out. And he either walked me to the subway or took me home to Brooklyn. I'm not sure exactly which. And we were together for another 11 years.
Yeah, that's great. So that's why I reached out to you when Llewellyn Davis came out, because I thought, I need to talk to Terry Thall. Because, as you said earlier, you like to think, is this all true? Especially for the younger people going to these movies. It's great to have voices like yours saying, yeah, it was well done and the acting was great. But these things aren't true, just so you know. So, do you
Well,
want
Llewyn Davis, I thought Llewyn Davis was dreadful.
to say a little bit?
The Dylan movie is okay, and I will tell you my reservations about it.
Sure.
Aside from the people who were left out of the movie, which, as I say, is everybody who wasn't famous.
So you had reservations about the Complete Unknown movie, or you had.
I did. Remember the people, that movie was about people I knew.
Right.
And the people who were left out were people I knew. So I'll try and be brief. The first is Dave. There is a scene with Dave in it. Bob comes to New York and he's looking for Woody, and he goes to a coffee house, and some guy comes up to him and tells him where Woody is. Woody wasn't there, but that's not the point. He directs him to a hospital. And that's supposed to be Dave. I didn't even realize that. And then you see Dave again once at a party, I think. They erased Dave. I am not into symbolism. I'm really lousy at symbolism. But what they did there was they had Van Ronk greeting Bob, saying, "Hi, Bob. Here is the world that you're coming to, the world of Woody Guthrie." And then Dave is gone. So they have Dave bringing Bob into the Woody Guthrie world, which he's going to leave. And in doing that, and never, ever, ever showing Dave again, they are, in effect, erasing Dave from the rest of the world.
It wasn't just in the movie that Van Ronk was erased. It's well known that Dylan stole the arrangement and chord progressions of Dave playing House of the Rising Sun, and Dylan recorded it, even though he knew Van Ronk was about to.
I'm going back
to end my life beneath that rising sun.
And the night of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people thought that it was possible that the United States and Cuba were going to bomb the hell out of one another.
Very, very, very scary.
It was a scary night, and they exaggerated enormously. And I've seen criticisms of them for what they did in the film. I don't criticize them. They wanted to make it as scary as they could.
And
they, I mean, it wasn't like that. People weren't running around, you know, like hysterical. But people were scared. People really and truly were scared. They showed Bob working in the Gaslight that night to a very small crowd. Bob was not there. Dave worked the Gaslight that night. I was there. There was a small crowd. Dave usually sold out the Gaslight. People didn't go out that night. They stayed home with their families because they were scared. And they showed Bob working to a small crowd. Dave worked the Gaslight that night. And later we took a bunch of people to our favorite restaurant in Chinatown for maybe we were thinking last meal. And then a bunch of them came back to my apartment. Again, they erased Dave. If they wanted Bob to work and sing that night, they could have put him any place. They did not have to put him in the room where David really was. And I think that sucked.
You know, the movie Forrest Gump, where he happened to be in all the places, all the right time, and get credit for things. And that sort of came across my head when I was watching a thing. Oh, he was there? Oh, when he was there at that time? Yeah.
And it's not that he wasn't. It's that David was.
Yeah, erased. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was erased. The second thing that I think that they did dreadfully was you refer to Susie as his wimpy girlfriend. Susie was a good friend of mine from the time she and Bob met until she died. She was a smart, capable, interesting, intellectually bright woman. She was young. She was 17 when they met. She turned 18 a few months later. She came from a communist home. She had a political background. She was active in the civil rights movement. She took Bob, and I'm not saying Bob was ignorant. He wasn't, but he had his own intellectual background. She had a different one.
Susie was with Bob from 1961 till 1964. She was an activist and an artist. She left the relationship when she wanted to preserve herself, her activism, rather than play second fiddle to his fame. She died in February 2011 at 67 years old. Here she is in her own words about who she was when she met Dylan.
Well, because I was from New York City. In New York, you're exposed to a lot more. Plus the family I came from, we didn't have much money, but we were very culturally, I always think of it as being culturally very, very wealthy. We didn't have a TV, but the house was filled with books and phonograph records, and we listened to the radio. I was exposed to all different kinds of music from a very early age. My mother loved Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, and Edith Piaf, and my father, and they listened to opera, classical records we had. It was very, very rich, and when you grow up in that, you just assume everybody else knows all this. But I knew an awful lot about music just from listening and hearing and being exposed to it, whereas with Bob, he heard this music and knew this is what he wanted to investigate, but he had a harder time finding it.
She turned him on to visual art. She took him to museums. She turned him on to Bertolt Brecht. Her sister, Carla, worked for off-Broadway theater producers. One of the productions that Carla worked for, and I think Susie had something to do with it, was a Brecht play. And Susie introduced Bob to that. Susie was a bright woman, and She didn't stand around. I mean, the Baez, Dylan, Susie triangle didn't happen.
Right.
Bob and whenever Bob and Joan got together, and I really know very little about that, it was a lot later.
Yeah.
It was either around the time that Bob and Susie broke up or after they broke up. It really, there was no relationship between Bob and Susie and their relationship, their breakup, and whatever happened with Bob and Joan. None at all. And what they did to Susie, I mean, they just showed Susie as a wimp, and she wasn't.
Right.
If they wanted to encapsulate the three of them together, they could have done that, but they didn't have to do that to Susie. They really didn't. And one of the other things that I resent very badly, and this may be the made-up scene that people talk about, I don't know. There is a scene where Pete has a radio show,
Right.
radio television,
Right.
and he comes in and he says to an old blues singer
Right.
who obviously is one of the people who was, quote, rediscovered in the 60s, who is on his radio show, who is sitting there in shirt sleeves holding a pint of whiskey in a paper bag. And he says to him, well, Bob was supposed to be on the show, but he can't be here today. And this guy is sitting there mumbling and saying how great he is and swigging his booze. Where the hell did they come off doing that? Nobody did that kind of thing. The guys who were rediscovered, the older blues singers, they were musicians. They came on a show and they acted like musicians. That I have never used the word racist in my life in public, never. So I won't use it now. But that was disgusting.
I was feeling
It
you
really
got
was. And then they have Bob coming in, and this
right.
guy hands him his guitar, or Bob takes his guitar, and the guy hands Bob the pint of booze, and Bob takes a sip, which is okay. I mean, and Bob sits and plays, and the guy admires him.
Right, takes the limelight.
Well, okay, Bob had learned to become a better guitarist when he hit New York. And, there's nothing wrong with that. He wasn't that good a guitarist by then, but that whole scene is why? I mean, what are they trying to do there?
Well,
Show
glorify.
Mississippi John Hurt? Show who? I don't get it. I really don't.
People in the village at the time would revere these terrific black blues singers. Here's Tom Paxton, he's at the Philly Folk Festival, remembering when he saw Mississippi John Hurt and giving him the respect he deserves.
I've been around a while now, and I've been thinking about another festival I went to back in 1963. The Newport Folk Festival, where I met a man who instantly won my heart, and he won the hearts of 18,000 people in the audience that night. He was a delightful man named Mississippi John Hurt, and I want to sing you a song for John. It was a frosty night, it was beginning to snow, and down the city streets the wind began to blow. We all came to the cellar, we all emptied the bar, to hear a little old fella play your shiny guitar. Did you hear John Hurt play the Creole bell, the Spanish fandango that he loves so well? Did you love John Hurt? Did you shake his hand? Did you hear him sing his Candyman?
And incidentally, the person who plays that blues singer is Mud Morgenfeld, who is Muddy Waters' son and a professional and a very good blues musician. I've seen his band and he's good. I have no idea why he did that.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about Llewellyn Davis and that movie and what you thought they got right. Not that it was a documentary, we have to say. It was not meant to be a
Do I
documentary.
have to launch from criticism to criticism?
Well, maybe not. Your overall
Overall,
vibe.
I hated it.
The whole movie.
I hated it. The music was very good, really good. Oscar Isaacs was wonderful. I thought he did a really, really good job.
Here is Oscar Isaac playing Green Green Rocky Road from the movie Llewellyn Davis. He was taught by Eric Frandsen, another good guitarist at the time of the movie. Eric was our MC for the Bob Dylan Imitators Night at the Speakeasy Club. More on that later.
No carpet on my floor, you come along and follow me. We'll go down to Galilee. Out in green, green, rocky road, you promenade in green. Tell me who you love, tell me who you love.
And from 1977, here's Van Ronk playing the same tune.
Generally, I sing this song too fast. I'm going to sing it at the right tempo. I'll sing the chorus for you one or two times, and then I expect you to do it.
The guy who played the jazz musician was great, really great. But I don't understand that movie. That being said, and again, I know it wasn't a biography of anybody, and they said it wasn't the story of Dave, but it was.
Yes.
They took a partial story of Dave before we met, when he was very young. When he had just gotten back from sea as a merchant seaman, he had been a merchant seaman when he was like 17. They took some very real scenes and they turned that stuff into a movie and they plugged Dylan into it. They took a really supportive folk music world and they turned it into a very unpleasant world. They took my ex-husband, who was an extraordinarily smart, again, smart, interesting, competent man, and they turned him into a schmuck. Somebody who couldn't cope, they turned him into a jerk. Why? I don't know. I mean, that's what they wanted to show, but then why use him? That's not what he was like. They turned that whole world into a depressing world. Everything they portrayed in it was wrong. They have a scene in which a club owner, and I can't remember whether it was obviously supposed to be the owner of the Gaslight or Gertie's Folk City. There is a woman on stage playing a dulcimer, a slightly heavyset woman. And somebody says to the club owner, did she? And they use the F word to get the gig. And he says, yes. That did not happen in that world. I am not saying that the folk music world was pure, but as it happens, that didn't happen ever, ever, ever. I am not saying that nobody ever hit on folk singers or on women. I was there. I was a young woman. I was an attractive young woman. It happened, but not by club owners. It just, and you got that kind of thing, quid pro quo for a gig, literally just didn't happen. It wasn't part of it, just that piece wasn't part of that world. And the woman they were talking about clearly was Jean Ritchie. That was insulting to Jean. It was insulting to the club owner. The whole thing was insulting. And what I hated the most, absolutely the most about that movie, they have a thing where the Dave character impregnates a young woman. And they have him trotting off to a local abortionist's office and saying, "I did it again." Mm-hmm. And the abortionist says to him, "Oh, well, you have a credit for the last one." This was the mid-1950s. Abortion was illegal. Nobody trotted into the office of their friendly neighborhood abortionist and said, "I need an abortion." Not women didn't do that. Men didn't do that for their girlfriends. You sweated blood if you needed an abortion. That was, again, I don't know what they were doing, but that was an attack on women. Nasty attack on women, on young women. I don't know.
Many people responded in 2013 when the Llewellyn Davis movie came out. Suzanne Vega was written up in the New York Times. People didn't like the way they thought Dave was portrayed. Other people said, no, it's just a slice of the times, and it wasn't about Dave necessarily. At the time, I talked to Andrea Focolo, his widow, and she was asked over and over the same question.
Have interviewed me, and they're saying, what do you think Dave would have thought about the movie? And I mean, honestly, I don't know, but this big controversy it has engendered would have amused the hell out of him.
Well, yes.
I know that.
Yes. The controversy he would have really got into. You're saying people are calling. Is there a renewed interest in Dave's music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just speaking with the people at Smithsonian. You know, they put out a 3-CD set of
yes.
Dave's music in October. And I just found out, you know, an hour ago that they've gone into a second printing on it, a second pressing.
Excellent.
Because of the interest in the movie, I think just about everything Dave has ever recorded is available for downloading right now.
So let's hope the Dylan movie currently and the Llewellyn Davis continue to bring attention to Dave Van Ronk, no matter what your opinion is of either movie. Now back to Terry Thall.
When I go to see shows, I want to feel that they're representing the times. And so that...
I don't think the Coen brothers were behind the times. I think there was something deliberate about it.
Hmm.
They're not stupid. I mean, that's my sense of it. And the whole movie, you know, the whole movie was like that.
Well, I'm really glad that both Susie and you did your own books to document your side of what your life was like and why you slid in and out of the world of the village. Where can people get your book now?
Amazon.
Amazon, great.
Amazon is the best, or Barnes & Noble online is really the best, you know, the best way to get it. And my book is about, I have a fair amount about the folk music world and the club scene and the people who hung out in my living room. And I have a chapter about working with Bob. I did manage Bob and I managed Dave. I really always feel that I have to point out that Dave and I separated in the late 1960s. We were lived together for 11 years, but we didn't fight. We separated, we broke up. We both wound up with other people very happily, but we stayed very good friends for the rest of our lives. And I'm very comfortable talking about that world because we liked and respected one another forever. It was a great world.
He never left it. He ended up, like, I didn't know you, but I knew Dave because he came to help with the speakeasy and he was on our board and
right.
very involved with McDougal Street and the folk scene. And there he was, just the mayor of McDougal Street.
Yeah.
In the present.
And I came back years later. I left for a while and then I came back years later and loving the music, which is still going.
And is something coming up where you're speaking about your book?
There will be a forum about the movie.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be four writers, Richard Barone, David Brown, myself, and Stephen Petrus, at the Bitter End on February 7th. And then I'm doing a book talk in Ossining. There's a wonderful bookstore. I mean, it is totally involved with the community, and it's a great bookstore in Ossining, Hudson Valley Books, on March 15th.
Okay, so something in February and something in March.
Yeah.
Thank
And I have a tape that Bob made for me, an audition tape that was made for me in 1961. And that's going up for auction, with
you.
our auction online.
And
It's
what's that?
our auction. It's their website.
Okay. That's great. Is this the tape that you took around like to try and get some
Yeah.
gigs? And people
Yes.
were saying,
Yes.
we don't want to hear another Rambling Jack Elliott. Yeah.
That's right.
People like to, when I was running the speakeasy, everybody who came in to me sounded like they were trying to beat Dylan. So I just said, you know what? Let's just have a weekend called the Imitation
Really?
Bob Dylan Weekend. So people came and they were
That's
imitating.
fun.
Yeah. And then we had Mike Porco and Cynthia Gooding. We had people come and be judges who knew him.
Oh,
And
really?
that was really fun. You can actually see that on YouTube. You can put it in on YouTube. And
Nah. I've heard enough with these.
yes, I know. Yes. Well, I was getting tired of that. So I thought, oh, we'll just give them their own weekend. And it was very
How
successful.
funny, Angela. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that was a fun thing. So I'm going to insert here and play for you what it sounded like June 22nd, 1983, at the Speakeasy on McDougal Street, a club I ran, and I came up with this idea since everybody was trying to sound like Dylan when they were auditioning. Let's just do it. Let's just have an evening of everybody singing like Dylan. Here's Eric Franzen doing the intro. I mentioned before that Eric learned from Dave Van Ronk. And when Dave Van Ronk had passed, the star of Llewellyn Davis learned to pick, and Eric was one of his teachers. Here he is introducing the show. The judges were Mike Porco, who ran Folk Plus, Cynthia Gooding, Jeffrey Stokes, a writer for the Village Voice, and I can't remember the fourth one. But let me take you back to 1983.
Welcome to the Speakeasy, the home of slick professionalism in New York and fire hydrant of the underdog. We're going to prove that this evening. This is the first annual Bob Dylan Imitators Contest. Now, the contest is sanctioned and held under the rules that a Bob Dylan Imitators Commission of the State of New York. There are four judges who will do the scoring. Decision of the judges is final. We have a whole raft of contestants in five categories. The first category is folk protest, Bob Dylan. The second, amphetamine rock, Bob Dylan. The third is post-motorcycle accident voice change, Bob Dylan. The fourth, late rock and roll, born again to present. And the fifth category is, of course, to save till last, because it's always the most exciting, the fabulous freestyle competition. Decisions of the judges are final. There will be two prizes awarded in each category with a grand prize overall.
Now I'm going to cut to who won the overall evening, Frank Christian.
Please welcome Bob Dylan, number 26.
Well, time ago, a crazy dream came to me. You guys, welcome, Roy. Well, I went to the doctor the very next day to see the kind of words he could say. He told me it was a bad dream. Won't worry about it, none of those crazy dreams are only in your head. He said, Doc, I dreamt the World War came through my brain. He said, Nurse, get your pad, the boys, and sing. She grabbed my arm, I said, out. She landed on a psychiatric couch. She said, tell me about it. Well, Well, the whole thing started at 3 o'clock fast, all over by a quarter past. I was down the sewer with some little lover when I peeked up from a manhole cover. Wondering who turned the lights on. Well, Doc interrupted me right about then, saying, I've been having that same old dream. I don't know, I wish Woody were here right now. He'd remember those words. Never doubt a stage fright before. Oh, when they gotta cut something easy. Well, times have changed and now it seems everybody's having them dreams. Everybody sees themselves walking around with no one else. But half the people can be part right some of the time, and all the people can be all right part of the time, but all the people can't be all right all the time. I think Mike Porco said that. I'll let you be in my dream if I could be in yours, I said.
So that was the Speakeasy on McDougal Street in Greenwich Village, the Bob Dylan Battle of the Bobs, someone named it, but I called it the Bob Dylan Imitators Contest, and we awarded many things. There was a rumor going around that Bob himself was going to give a guitar. That was never promised. I don't know how that rumor started, but we had all the news people there, ABC, NBC. It was quite the affair. I asked Terry if she still lived in the village.
No, I left the village. I loved the village. I adored it. I was there for 40 years.
It's enough.
I was living with somebody else, guy I met after Dave and I separated, and I don't know why we got the leaving the city urge. We fell in love with old country tools,
yeah,
and kitchenware, and eventually, actually, he started a store in the village, and I was working for not-for-profit organizations, and we moved up to Rockland County, where I live now, not that far from you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very different.
Are you writing other than your book? Are you just relaxing now because it's time?
I am up to my eyeballs in a lot of environmental work.
Ah, still.
I've been doing local environmental work for years.
Good.
Land saving, water conservation. Rockland County has a strange water situation. The only source of water is the sky. We don't get water in from anywhere else, and I'm very active in that.
Great, thank you for that. That's important.
It's part of what I do, and I'm active in the Rockland Coalition to End the New Jim Crow and some other stuff. And yes, I am writing. I'm beginning to work on something else.
All right.
I'm not sure where it'll go, but my fingers and the computer like each other.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it, that your brain can just go through your fingers all onto this page and you can just race along.
Yeah, it's a good thing because I can't read my handwriting anymore.
Tara explained when you're writing a book, your editor can limit you to a certain amount of words. And she was elaborating and trying to explain the times to people who weren't there and were too young to know about them. And here she is explaining why a lot of the book was cut.
You know, I mean, I felt that if I referred to the McCarthy thing, I had to explain it.
Yeah. Well,
you have to. I want young people, you know, who knows, who remembers what it is. So I spent a page and a half talking about the McCarthy thing. I refer to the permanent revolution. I have to explain it. Who the hell knows what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
They cut it all out and I cried.
Well, that is an understandable response. And we talked about how, as teachers, both of us former teachers, it's really important to educate young people. And that's what I thought about the Complete Unknown movie, because younger people might take it more of a documentary, and it's good to get out there some of the things that are true and that are not true. Here's her thought about the young people in the movie.
Well, I'm just trying to give the younger people more of the reality so they don't take it too much like a documentary. So.
Yeah, and young people are not going to see it until it gets online, someplace where they can see it electronically. You go to the theater, there is not a young person in there.
Yeah.
And I've heard this from everyone who's seen it.
Yeah, they'll wait and see it a different way.
Yeah.
Terry shared that she does speaking engagements. She's doing one February 7th at the Bitter End with David Brown, who works at Rolling Stone, and a couple of other authors about books they've written about the era. And she's speaking in Ossining at the Hudson Valley Bookshop. And she talked a little bit about what she does at these engagements.
There's all this stuff that I talk about. I talk about left-wing politics. I talk about social justice world. I talk about the folk music world. I talk about age. I talk about age and sexuality a little bit. I talk about feminism a little bit. It's all a little bit. There are bits and pieces of all this stuff here in the book and in what I talk about, because I don't really talk that much about the book. When I do talks, I don't read. I've never read from the book.
Well, it's been so great for you to share with the listeners of Folk Plus. I really, really appreciate it. Again, give us the title of your book.
My book is called My Greenwich Village, Dave, Bob, and Me.
And you guys can get it on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble. Well, thanks for visiting with us. I totally appreciate it.
Angela, thank you so much. It is a treat. We talked about doing this 12 years ago.
And we have more to talk about this time. So that was, I'm glad we waited.
Thank you.
So last weekend, I went to see Complete Unknown. And I waited outside the theater and I caught a few people's responses to the movie.
Hi, my name's Sarah Reed and I love the movie. I just love listening to Bob Dylan's music. And it's all about his words, I think. And I thought they did a great job.
Hi, I'm Joe Johnson. You know, we saw Dylan at Bethel Woods this summer, and I was a little disappointed that he didn't play any of his classic stuff. And now I can understand why. You know, he's a man who wants to move on and constantly be performing new stuff and breaking new ground, and I understand it a little bit more now.
Hey, I'm Karen Hudson, singer-songwriter, and I've just left A Complete Unknown. And I actually, this is my second time seeing it. The tunes have been, like, going through my head all week. It was just like an amazing romp through an era, visually, musically. Everything was so well done. It was just really quite incredible. And Bob Dylan certainly was a force, and he didn't really give a crap about what anybody thought. And I loved that about him.
This brings an end to the hour of Terry Thall and her book, My Greenwich Village, David, Bob, and Me. Perhaps you'll pick up a copy before or after you go out and see either one of those movies. This has been Folk Plus. I'm Angela Page.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Morgan Outdoors. Celebrating 20 years as a local source for hiking, snowshoeing, and discovering the great outdoors. On Main Street in Hurleyville, near the rail trail. Morgan-Outdoors.com.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.